Cases are rising and restrictions are coming back. The mayor of Atlanta wants to move her city back to phase one lockdown.
The governor of Texas says he may be forced to do the same. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro, and this is Up First from NPR News. Testing is key to getting a handle on this virus. We'll see how America's testing system is holding up.
Also, Donald Trump commutes Roger Stone's sentence. The president's advisor embraces the title, Dirty Trickster.
Well, I'm stuck with it now. It's going to be in the first paragraph of my New York Times obit, so I might as well go with the flow. The only thing I can think of worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
And we'll look at the violence in Chicago. So stay with us. We'll give you the news you need to start your weekend.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp, online counseling by licensed professional counselors specializing in isolation, depression, stress, and anxiety. Visit betterhelp.com/upfirst to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Roger Stone, Republican operative and longtime friend of Donald Trump, remains a free man.
Stone was convicted of lying to Congress as it investigated Trump's 2016 campaign. He was due to report to federal prison next week. The conviction stands, but last night he got a phone call.
Just a few minutes ago, I had a very gracious call from the President of the United States, who told me that he had decided to use his extraordinary powers of clemency to commute my sentence.
NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has been following the Stone case, and Ryan is with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the White House, in an official statement, called Stone a victim of, quote, the Russia hoax. What else do we know about why Trump decided to commute Stone's sentence?
Well, Trump has long been a critic of the Russia investigation, and in particular, the prosecution of Stone. And in this statement last night, the White House says that Stone was charged by what it calls overzealous prosecutors on special counsel Robert Mueller's team, pursuing a case that, in the White House's view, never should have existed. It says that Stone would not be facing prison time if Mueller's team hadn't been pursuing what it calls a baseless investigation. In essence, what the White House is saying is that Stone is a victim of an unfair investigation. The White House also raised questions about possible bias on the jury in Stone's trial, saying that the foreperson was biased against Trump. I will say that Stone himself raised these issues in court. The judge examined them and ultimately rejected them. The White House also raises in its statement health concerns about sending Stone, who is 67, to prison. Now, the White House's view on Stone's case is very different from that of Attorney General William Barr, who, as we know, is no fan of the Russia investigation. Barr said in the past week that Stone's prosecution was, quote, righteous, and that his sentence was fair.
So remind us of how the Russia investigation resulted in charges against Stone, because it seems lost somehow in the mists of time and ultimately gave him a conviction.
It has been a long and winding road, this this prosecution. So
yes.
Stone was the last person, actually, who was charged as part of the Mueller investigation. And he was charged with lying to Congress, with obstruction and witness tampering. And all of those charges related to Stone's attempts to keep secret his efforts during the 2016 campaign to learn what WikiLeaks planned to do with hacked Democratic emails, emails that the U.S. government says were hacked by Russia's intelligence services. And of course, those emails became a major focus of the 2016 presidential race. Stone fought these charges. He went to trial. He was convicted by a jury in November on all seven counts. He was sentenced to 3 years and 4 months in prison. And as you noted earlier, he was scheduled to report to prison next Tuesday.
This commutation is being seen by the president's critics as the president abusing his special powers for his friends and allies and subverting justice. So the political fight over the Russia investigation isn't over. But do you think this move by the president could change the dynamics of that fight going forward?
It's hard to see this moving the needle at all, either way. Both sides in this fight over the Russia investigation are pretty well entrenched at this point. And we see that in the reaction to the president's decision to commute Stone's sentence. A key Trump ally on the Hill, Republican Congressman Jim Jordan, for example, says that he supports this move by the president. Democrat Jerry Nadler is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Nadler put out a statement on Twitter last night saying that Trump's decision to commute Stone's sentence has infected the country's judicial system with partisanship and cronyism and attacked the rule of law. And he says that his committee will investigate. So these lines, these battle lines on this investigation are well known at this point.
That's NPR's justice correspondent, Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for more from Ryan and his colleagues who cover the White House, Congress, and political campaigns, you can check out the NPR Politics Podcast. The spread of the coronavirus accelerated this week, especially in southern states. Thursday and Friday's case counts alone topped 60,000 people. That would be an overflow crowd for Dodger Stadium.
This crush of new cases is straining the nation's testing system. Joining us now to talk about that is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Good morning.
Good morning, Lulu.
We've been seeing images of these endless lines of people waiting to get tested in some places and hearing stories about testing centers that book up for the day just minutes after they open. You know, we are months into this pandemic. What is behind this new crush?
Well, most of the testing problems are due simply to volume. As the disease accelerates, more and more people want to get tested. And frankly, the testing system is just not keeping up. And that's a problem considering that epidemiologists say they think local health authorities should be ramping up to test maybe twice as many people as they do now. I talked to Dr. Michael Minna at the Harvard School of Public Health.
We are seeing an unfortunate delay in testing and essentially the capacity issues have reemerged. It almost feels like deja vu from April now.
I mean, clearly this is very frustrating for people who might be sick, who want to get tested. But what about from a public health standpoint? What are they saying?
Well, the way to stop the epidemic is to identify people who are spreading the virus, right? So say someone has come in contact with a friend who came down with COVID-19. If they want to find out if they've been infected, they might at first struggle to get a test. And then even when they get to the front of the line, they might have to wait 4 or 6 days or even longer to get their results. And by then, of course, they may well have spread the disease to a bunch of other people.
So what is the solution then? Because clearly this has been a persistent problem here.
Absolutely. And for starters, traditional labs need more equipment and a more reliable supply of the ingredients they need to run these tests. But probably the nation also needs new technology. There are now 2 new tests that can run in doctor's offices that take about 15 minutes. And those can provide reasonably good results. Though, you know, it will probably take until early fall for production of those so-called antigen tests to ramp up into the millions, which is really kind of what we're talking about here. Dr. Minna is pushing for the next generation of technology to take this farther.
I envision a time when everyone can order a pack of 50 tests for $50 and use them every other day for a couple of months. And ultimately, people will continuously know their status as to whether they've been exposed or infected and can make the right decisions on a daily basis.
And that's not just science fiction. Tests like that are actually in the works, although I haven't heard anyone promising to sell them at $1 a pop.
But how would that look? Would this be like, I guess, buying home pregnancy tests?
That's the concept, absolutely. And some of these are based on a revolutionary technology called CRISPR. We think of that as a gene editing technology, but actually part of that editing process involves finding specific genetic sequences to get edited. So in this case, the test looks for viral genetic sequences, and then instead of editing, it basically raises a flag and says, hey, I found it. And I talked to the CEO of one of the companies that's actually rapidly developing this kind of technology. Trevor Martin is at Mammoth Biosciences near San Francisco.
What's exciting about the type of molecular testing that we're doing at Mammoth with CRISPR is that that's really able to target the very early asymptomatic stage, which is super important if you want to prevent spread.
Okay, this is the main question. When will people actually be able to get those tests?
Right, and that's not the great news here. Mammoth has partnered with pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline in order to develop and mass produce a consumer product. Martin says he hopes to have something available by the end of the year, which seems like an eternity, right? Though the first test may be administered in a lab as opposed to being a home test. There are lots of other companies out there working on all sorts of other technologies, but of course, and unfortunately, the epidemic won't simply pause and wait for all this work to get done.
No, indeed it won't. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Richard, thank you so much.
Happy to be with you, Lulu.
At least 17 people have been shot in Chicago just since yesterday afternoon.
Every weekend over the past 90 days, Chicago has watched as dozens have been wounded or killed in shootings. And President Trump is making something of it. He talked to Sean Hannity about it on Fox this week.
what's going on in Chicago, and we are looking at it very seriously because we're going to have to do something. We've asked them, you know, we're really supposed to be asked to come in and help the federal government, and we have the greatest people in the world, and we can solve it.
Patrick Smith is a criminal justice reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Patrick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How grave is the gun violence problem in Chicago right now?
It's very grave. You know, in the first 6 months of the year, nearly 1,700 people were shot in Chicago. 329 people were killed. The city's on pace for more murders this year than we've had in more than a decade. Just last weekend, the 4th of July weekend, nearly 90 people were shot. 17 of them died. Another weekend in June, a few weeks before that, there were more than 100 people shot between Friday and Monday. And one thing that's really scary for the people out on the street is that a lot of the shootings lead to retaliation, which means even more shootings. So the outlook is not good right now.
And it is almost too hard to think about the fact that so many of the victims of gun violence have been children.
That's right. So far this year, more than 25 kids have been killed by guns in Chicago. Actually, just last night, a 15-year-old boy was killed by gunshots to the back, according to police. A couple weeks ago, I spoke with the mother of a 13-year-old girl named Amarie Jones, who was hit and killed by a stray bullet that came through her family's front window. Her mom told me that her 13-year-old daughter was showing her a dance move in the family's front room when she was hit in the neck. The info we have on most of these cases, the child was obviously not the target. Rather, they were with a family member maybe who was targeted or just a stray bullet. And many of the children killed have been elementary school age or even younger. So obviously it's just impossible to convey the tragedy and loss for these families.
Recognizing that every case is a tragedy and different, what seems to be behind many of these shootings? You mentioned retaliation. What response has there been from the city to try and interrupt that? And we understand Chicago police are about to launch a new unit that is centered on neighborhoods with the highest rates of violence.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so as far as what's driving these, the info that I've gotten from police and anti-violence workers on the street is that these shootings are mostly done by young men who are involved with gangs, and that it's often interpersonal conflicts that escalate into shootings. And then, as you mentioned, they turn into these cycles of retaliation with groups going back at one another, you know, in their eyes, sort of righteous anger that they're acting out to avenge someone else's shooting. To combat this, police are trying a few different tactics. They started up a mobile summer unit that responds to violence hotspots. And you mentioned CPD is launching a new citywide anti-violence unit that's supposed to respond to areas that see a surge in shootings. This is a tactic that's been tried before in the city, and actually these specialized shooting units have been disbanded in the past out of concern that they alienate residents and hurt police community relations, although the relatively new superintendent says they're taking steps to make sure that doesn't happen this time. The city's also been investing in community-based gang intervention efforts outside of police efforts.
President Trump has leveled a finger at Chicago's violence for a long time, trying to make a political point, and talked about federal intervention. What's his response been recently to this increase in shootings?
Well, he sent a letter a couple weeks ago to the Chicago's mayor and the governor of Illinois, saying he was horrified by the shootings in Chicago and offering help. He's never really been specific about what kind of help he's offering. And the local leaders here in Chicago, all of them Democrats, have rejected his offers as political posturing. The people in Chicago that I've spoken with, many of them, they say they don't believe the president really cares about the problem here. But I have heard from some people who say, hey, whatever you think of him, if the president is offering federal help, we should take it because we need all the help we can get.
Patrick Smith of member station WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Thank you.
And that's Up First for Saturday, July 11th. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And I'm Scott Simon. Up First, back Monday with news you need to start your week. You can follow us on social media. We are at Up First on Twitter. And keep an eye on this feed for the occasional special episode.
And for more news, interviews, and so much more, try us, yes, on the radio.
The radio! Weekend edition, Saturday and Sunday mornings. You can find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
Whenever you face a choice, it helps to think like an economist. And this week on Planet Money Summer School, we'll start off our course in economics with a workout for your brain, how to decide what something truly costs. Listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
Support for NPR and this message come from St. Joseph's University. With graduate degree programs for leaders in business, healthcare, education, and data analytics. Changemakers with the courage to redefine the future of the world. More at sju.edu/NPR.